10, we continue with the conceptual framework, final item for this month.
Thank you. I'll hand straight over to Andrew for the first paper on initial measurement.
Thanks very much indeed, Rachel, and good afternoon, everybody. The papers that we're to discuss this afternoon are the last planned discussion on measurement, and paper 10B in particular looks at factors specific to initial measurement. As the paper sets out, we didn't get a huge number of comments on initial measurement. However, we've taken the view that it was probably unsafe to assume that the vast majority of respondents who didn't comment were entirely happy with it. It may well be that they had just their focus on other issues, and therefore we think that the comments that we've received need to be taken fairly seriously. There were some reservations. There was one standard setter who thought that perhaps we should just strike the whole section on initial measurement and leave it to be dealt with at the standards level. But nonetheless, having reviewed those comments, we take the view that what the exposure draft said was essentially sound, but that it would be helpful to clarify it in a number of respects. One of the respects that seems to be is the language that is used. The exposure draft contrasted exchanges of items of similar value with other kinds of transactions. And having reflected on that, we're suggesting that is not perhaps the most appropriate language. Exchanges of items of similar value seems rather vague. And also it may be misleading because outside of organized markets, like the stock exchange or whatever, most transactions don't necessarily give evidence of similar value. They give evidence that one party valued the other thing more than what they were giving. And so one of our suggestions is that we try to find an alternative. The alternative that we float in the paper is arm's length transactions and trying to distinguish those from others. There's nothing particularly wonderful necessarily about the term arm's length, and there are other possibilities, such as market value or negotiated transactions. IFRS 13 uses the term orderly. But perhaps that's the place to lead into a discussion of the questions in question one, which are, do you agree that we should retain the main body of the principles as set out in the exposure draft with appropriate clarification, and that we should move away from the terms of exchanges of items of similar value?
Mary?
At a very high level, agree with the idea of retaining the main principles that we had. I had a specific concern that I'm thinking may relate more to question two, so beat me back if it is more question two than question one, which is one comment that was reported that really struck me was some potentially unintended consequences and of statements about transactions with holders of equity claims. Mm-hmm. In terms of reading what we wrote almost as descriptions, as introducing a requirement to remeasure all transactions with shareholders to current value, regardless of the stated amount or the book value of consideration given. It's not that I think that is a bad idea that we should avoid, but it's one that we haven't deliberated and reached a conclusion to do. So I think that caution from one of the standard setters is a good one. I think it may relate more to question two, but it kind of has some relation to question one. And that concern that they expressed made me stand back and look at the drafting and how we presented this section, this whole section. So on your specific point about what terminology do we use, I see why we reached for arm's length, but I worry that that might be difficult to explain and translate if it's a term that's more specific to few markets that we might be more familiar with. And I wonder if we should pick up the language that's in our related party standard 24 carried out on market terms as the phrase that we use to differentiate market terms from non-market terms, and because it's a term we use already in connection with this type of transaction. So that's terminology. But the other thing I suggest is, rather than discussing different categories of transactions as we did in the ED, I'm not going to do it right in terms of what the categories were, but it's something like those of equivalent value, those with holders of equity claims, et cetera, that if what we're writing is a description, then I think maybe we start out and say the following description is based on the assumption that the transaction has been carried out on market terms, without focusing as much on the identity of the counterparty, or with requiring an assessment of the terms in order to figure out which paragraph you're in. And then we can figure out to what extent we wish to make comment about transactions that are carried out not on market terms. And to me, the big caution that we have to offer is, if a transaction is carried out not at market terms, it may be because there's another explicit or implicit transaction related to that. Yep. And if that's the case, then you need to think about whether there's another transaction that you need to identify and account for. An example I could give you is, if I have a building on my balance sheet that has a book value of 100 and a market value of 150, and you're my subsidiary, and I force you to buy it from me for 250, I think you probably made a distribution to me as well as acquiring an asset. I think it's entirely fair to say that accounting just for the acquisition of the asset at the amount of the consideration paid would not be a faithful representation of either the transaction or of the asset that you're left with. But I think if we start trying to slice things in the conceptual framework, we might end up writing guidance that is directly and immediately effective for transactions that we haven't really deliberated, because some of these transactions with owners may be one of the topics that people look to the conceptual framework for today, because they may be, like BizCom under common control, explicitly scoped out of the scope of applicable standards. So I'm urging caution. Think about what it is we're trying to address, and I think we're trying to mostly comment about the plain vanilla on market terms. Let's focus on those and maybe give some cautions rather. So I think it's keeping the principles, but being clear about what we were trying to address when we set them out. So I think it's mostly drafting. And a lot of caution around how much we say about transactions with holders of equity claims.
Yes, there I have a totally the same idea as Mary suggested, arm's length transaction. Yet to my memory, it was one of the big terms to translate in Korean. It was very difficult. Just physically, we say the one length of arm. That was in Korea, it's a kind of a translation, because we didn't know what this means.
And there are many transactions in one length of arms? Or?
Yeah, maybe. All kinds of transactions possible. Yeah, so as an alternative, that Mary suggests a kind of market terms. Another thing is in the paragraph 11, Deloitte suggests another terminology, fair transactions or orderly or negotiated transactions. That's another alternative. That's one thing on the terminology. Second thing is the meaning of this two classification of the arm's length transactions other than arm's length. Because I'm a little about dubious about this means is if you see paragraph 670 of your paper 10C, if you see that the example of a C or D, a liability may be imposed by legislation. Another thing is a liability, blah, blah, blah. may arise from actable wrongdoing. So this kind of transactions that result of that transaction is a liability. Is it a non other than armed line yes. transaction? I'm just curious.
Yeah, I think that's exactly what we were trying to say. We brought in some of those examples because some of the respondents noted that they didn't seem to be captured by the text that we had before.
Big one.
Mary and Chong's suggestion remind me the debate when we amend the related party disclosure requirement. I use one example repeatedly and got different answer. I don't think your suggestion can answer these issues very clearly. The board decides during that time, the Chinese government said, the transaction are fair among government controlled entity. Now what I want to discuss nothing to do with China, but example shows it's not so easy. And the board decides, okay, if find any unfair transactions, even $1, you should disclose all the transactions at all. Then I give one example. It's quite popular in any market. Assume the London, let's assume the London city dominated by a big taxi company. And the company negotiated with the BMW. They said, we want to replace all the cars, And the market price is 10,000. But, this is a big market, Can we reach an agreement? And the BMW agree, 5,000. It's much lower than market price.
Yeah.
But BMW's intention is to penetrate the market. If London use these cars, and other city will feel, oh, great, we should use the car too. And I ask board members and the staff, is it this transaction, at market term, or is it fair? And some board members say, no, of course not. No market price 10,000. This case you only pay 5,000. And other staff say, or board members say, fair. It's because BMW, like to surrender with the expectations to get more market shares in the market. So Chung-Wu and Mary, whether this transaction
is fair. Let's take the example of steel, for example.
Pardon?
Let's take the example of steel.
WTO. I mean, to me, what I was suggesting just puts down the marker that we already have. I agree that market terms won't give you an automatic answer to your question. That's always a single answer. Yes, it's right, no, it's wrong, but it says you have to stop and look at that and make a decision and an assertion about whether the 5,000 that you negotiated was because you were trying to, penetrate a market, bulk discount, et cetera, or because there's something else going on. And you have to address that. But because we haven't debated that for the conceptual framework project, mm-hmm. I'm worried about having too specific and explicit, and even to me, yep. saying fair transaction implicitly requires you to have a benchmark against which you say, and it's a new term, is this transaction fair or not, as opposed to saying, referring to a benchmark we already have. So I don't think it'll answer, it won't give Weiguo a clear, this is always or this is never, but it flags what the consideration is.
But I think both terms got similar problems. If you say feel fair, it's hard,
yeah.
but then market term
has
similar problem.
But remember the research that the South Koreans and the Australians gave to us on terms of probability. Pick a phrase and use the same phrase if you mean the same thing. Don't vary it standard to standard.
So may I to just
yes,
caught between warring parties.
I think we. My perception that you and Weiguo are on the same page, but in different paragraphs. So my perception is that you wisely suggest to keep an eye on the terminology, a terminology that is already used and could be more easily translated. And I've tried here translating arm's length to Portuguese. There is no meaning at all. I do not recall how we translated. But in Brazil, in Portuguese Brasilia, we tend to embrace more known terminology in other languages and incorporate into Portuguese. But anyway, I just sent an email to check. So that's my sense of your suggestion to staff. And I guess Weigu is going a little bit ahead of this, is in a paragraph two or three aspects into the standard itself, how we are going to explain how this is going to be applied. Yeah, am I right on this? So I think if we are talking to the conceptual framework team, I would very much appreciate if they consider your suggestion to have a word that is already used in other standards. And we will be aware of Weigu's concern when developing standards in or clarify anything. Right?
Yeah. Doc, thank you.
I don't know the response was needed. So.
All right.
Thank you. Sorry.
Thank you. First of all, I have to say this was an improvement. And after reading this, I now know what the problem is all about. And regarding terminology, I agree with Mary and others. And because the word arm's length is used in variety of occasions, and especially in the tax conversation, we use this term, and there are a variety of definitions all across the jurisdiction. So therefore, we have to be careful. Also, we have to be careful to do this type of negative indicator list. So it looks like a standard basis. And then another more fundamental question is, so if it's not the arm's length transaction, then eventually day one profit or day one losses would be justified. So then the day one gains would be justified as a performance. And then actually conceptual framework does not really depict why it's a performance. And if it's a case of arm's length, then you recognize it as historical cost. Eventually, you would not recognize any day one gain. But if it's not arm's length, then you would recognize differences yeah. as a performance of that term. Mm-hmm. Then why? That should be explained a little bit more. Okay. And I struggle with the difference between this agenda paper and this proposal and IFRS 13. IFRS 13 already talks about the fair value at initial recognition. So we already have IFRS 13, and we are now conducting a PIR of IFRS 13. So I do not think it is a good idea to make a kind of this type of list style, negative list style of wording in the conceptual framework.
All right.
Right. Well, I think that's very helpful suggestions, and we'll certainly consider using a term such as market or something other than arm's length going forward. And that will have the additional benefit that I won't have to remember how to type a non-breaking hyphen, which you seem to need for arm's length. Shall we move on to question two, which is about transactions with holders of equity claim, which was probably the bit.
I think we probably don't actually need a vote. I think we've got a suggestion for how we go about amending some of the terminology, which we'll incorporate in. I think from the sort of general discussion, I don't think there were major concerns with the idea that we move ahead with that subject to the drafting requirements and then subject to the additional questions that we've got coming along later in this. Is that a fair summary?
It is, but I wanted to go back to the other half of the comment that I raised initially. One was the terminology, but the other is in question 1B, and I'm agreeing with you about not voting explicitly on it, but talks about distinguishing between instead of referring to terms of exchanges of similar value and exchanges of different value, that still presumes that we're talking about transactions in categories.
Yeah.
And I think maybe a bigger rethink of how we approach this thing can maybe condense it down and talk about kind of a norm, and I'm not talking as I wish it to be drafted, a normal transaction,
yeah,
and then think about to what extent we want to comment about other transactions, because I think that will focus us on deciding what it is we actually have deliberated.
Okay.
And yeah, things that we might think are just observations, but actually when you read them in another context have greater implications than...
Yeah, as I understand your suggestion, really, the idea is that the section would start off by making the strong assumption that this is all about arms like bear market transactions. and
arms like transactions by another name.
Yeah. And then sort of say, by the way, if it's not a market transaction, then there might be other things to think about,
right,
but not get into any great detail about what those other, you know, not try and lay down the law as to exactly how you would deal with non-arm's length transactions, you know, or non-market transactions. But yeah, I think that's something that we could,
okay,
certainly have a go at, and I don't see any reason why it wouldn't work or that we would lose anything of great importance in doing so. So I think that's a helpful suggestion.
So Weiguo is shaking his head.
So then we have to get into what market, you know, active, not active, or ordinary, not active.
That's,
I don't think we do.
No.
I don't think that would be the level of detail that we'd sort of envisage.
No, this is exactly, I don't want to, you know, change something which could be on the fly, you know.
Because I don't think we go into that level of detail in IS 24 anyway. I think we have that as a concept in IS 24, and I think in the conceptual framework we don't even need to go as far as we would in a standards level such as IS 24. So I think it's just an idea of, you have to think of this notion as to whether this transaction is a market transaction on an arm's length basis, but you don't have to go into the details of exactly what that means. I think that gets into the standard level type of detail.
Yeah. I think the level of detail is really a separate question from what term you use. I think whichever term you pick is then quite legitimate to say, well, it doesn't answer, you know, every question, or mm-hmm, you know, one can think of a number of examples where people might take a different view as to whether it was in or out.
All right, continue.
Okay. I'm not quite sure to what extent question two has now already been addressed and fallen away, but it's about transactions with holders of equity claims. And this was an area which attracted perhaps the most significant number of reservations in the paper. In the paper, we suggest that it may well be worth retaining the principle that if you have a market transaction for equity, then you should measure it at the current value of the asset received rather than some other amount and a contribution from owners. We also suggest that, and this was only came from one respondent, I think it was a fierce comment, that we didn't address incurring liabilities to pay dividends, and I think we can probably do that. But in the light of comments received, we would specifically make it clear that whatever we say about this does not apply to non-market transactions, although that would fall away if we accept the suggestion Mary did, that we start off by saying this section is all about market transactions.
Just a clarification. In 2B, it says specifically holders of equity in their capacity as such.
Yeah.
But I presume that applies more generally, right? So the first, for 2A, for example, it's not all transactions with somebody who happens,
yes,
to be a shareholder. It's in their capacity as...
Absolutely. Yes.
Mary?
I would be happy to be proved wrong, but I have a feeling that 2B could result in something that I know is very different from practice, which is, if I go back to the building I was going to make Andrew buy at an inflated price, book value of 100, fair value of 150, I think 2B would impose a requirement for me if I was going to pay a dividend to Andrew instead of requiring him to buy an asset at an inflated value. I think 2B would require me to remeasure my building to the 150 current value in order to record the liability to distribute the building at 150. Now, that might not be a bad route to go, but that would be a significant change to practice, and would be, I think, something that we would need to deliberate and perhaps consult about. So I'm not convinced that just making an observation about the inverse of the asset side is a non-controversial, just for the sake of completeness, addition. Because this whole thing about how you measure assets and whether it's the entity that records the remeasurement or not is, I think, part of what we're going to have to explore when we look at, for example, BISCOM under common control.
I certainly would agree that if that is the implication, and it may well be, then A, it would be good. It would be good accounting, but that it would be not something we should establish by a little bit of drafting in the conceptual framework.
And I think we would, given the lack of comment on this topic in any relevant standard, so that this in effect would immediately become effective as a requirement because of the conceptual framework.
I think we should. I would certainly agree that we should avoid doing that.
So that's why I question 2B.
So, Mary, your question 2B. My understanding, 2B is discussing the scenario when you issue shares, and already the company may declare dividends. Therefore, we call the share with rights. And the principles say that you should debit asset and credit equity, credit, dividend payable. I don't think there's any relationship to valuation of the asset.
Well, let's say, Weiguo, that what you are going to distribute, you declare a dividend today that you are going to pay July 1st, so after your half year, okay? And the dividend you declare today is a building that has a carrying value of 100. You now have a liability to pay that dividend to shareholders, right? What would you measure the liability for the distribution of the building at? I think 2B would say you have to measure it at current value. Mm-hmm. And I think current value would be the 150 value of the building. If you're going to credit liability for 150, and the building that you're going to distribute has a carrying value of 100.
Isn't this just what IFRIC 17 covers, though? Because IFRIC 17 also already talks about if you've got to deliver non-cash, if you've committed to make a non-cash distribution to an owner in the capacity as an owner, you measure it at its current value, and it doesn't touch the asset side.
Maybe it does. This is the concern I had about 2B, and it didn't seem to have been worked through or analyzed.
Yeah.
And so, Sue, you may well be right.
Yeah.
I hadn't thought about it. I was thinking back more to some earlier interpretation committee discussions, like.
I think IFRIC 17 deals with the difference between the value of the building and the distribution as a gain in profit or loss at the time that you actually make the distribution.
Yeah. So it doesn't change the carrying amount per se. But why don't we
look it up? I had only thought of this today as we were teeing it up, and it's just why I'm not convinced that simply adding in the symmetrical comment is a no-brainer's completion exercise.
I agree. I think you're right that we should have thought about it when we wrote the paper.
What you have described is related to 17 and A rather than B. B, I personally feel it's a very simple transaction. When the company issues shares and maybe 10 days ahead already declare dividends. The share price includes the value of the dividends, therefore what you should discount. Should be debit credit, nothing to do with the revaluation.
If it's only about something that detailed, then I don't think we have to address it in the conceptual framework. And if that's the transaction that we have in mind, that may be okay, but I'm worried that we're writing it generally in a way that scopes and other stuff. So I'm just saying, could staff go off and think further about that one?
Okay. So exclude this?
No. Think further.
Think further.
Think about.
Yeah, I think the question is whether we're creating, as it were, a new gap by writing something in the conceptual framework, which we shouldn't do without proper consideration and due process. And if that is the case, then probably we drop the point.
Thank you.
Just a clarification, I'm just curious. On this transactions with the holders of equity claims, we are changing the title of this section from exchanges of items of a similar value to transactions on arm's length terms, some kind of thing, yeah. So based on your paragraph 6.67, in this case, we can use a kind of transaction price at the initial measurement because that price is quite similar to the fair value. However, this is another transaction under this big framework. But here, we just say this kind of specific transaction with equity holders, you better use a current value. Mm-hmm. Not talking about anything on cost and fair value. So under the same framework, arm's length terms transactions, one is the cost, another one is because of our equity holders transaction, current value. So it isn't like that easy to follow the logic over here.
Okay.
Yeah, another thing is the question that I asked before, that paragraph 6.70 and C and D, a kind of a legislation liability, a kind of a wrongdoing damage liability, I was confused because you changed the exchanges items of different value to some transaction or not transaction, an event other than transaction at on arm's length terms. That means this part covers everything. Mm-hmm. That's not a transaction. That's not.
Yeah.
That I'm saying that everything you include, everything is included in this section, right?
Yes.
That's a little different from the previous ones, because the previous one is exchange that you used. So in this case, an event, even though that is not an exchange, you can include everything here. That's why this C and D of the paragraph 6.70 is okay. Is my understanding right?
Yes, I believe it is.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, certainly I was. I had envisaged that this section would cover both transactions that are not on market terms and things that arise from other events.
All right. Yeah. Okay.
Okay. The final major point before we come to sort of sweep up questions is on internally constructed assets. We've got a few comments, not terribly supportive on them. There are a couple of paragraphs in the exposure draft that, to me, didn't really seem to add very much, but rather gave rise to more questions than they answered. And on that basis, and the basis that they don't really take us forward very much, I'm suggesting that we simply delete the discussion of internally constructed assets. Do board members agree?
Agree.
Good. That's question three. Question four asks if you've got any other comments on the appendix, where I note a few comments that seem to me to be sufficiently isolated. That's not to merit discussion in the paper. And then finally, we did give you an illustrative redraft. I think in the light of the discussion that we've had this morning, we're going to try to change the draft really quite significantly. In terms of its structure, as well as in terms of terminology. But if you did have any comments you wish to make, then that would be good.
Okay.
Good.
Thank you.
We're done on B and C.
Julia.
So the exposure draft proposed that sometimes more than one measurement basis might be needed to provide relevant information about an asset, liability, income, or expense. In most cases, that would be best achieved via disclosure. However, in some cases, it may be necessary to use different measurement bases in the statement of financial position and the statement of profit or loss. Most respondents who commented on those proposals agreed with the disclosure of a different measurement basis. Many respondents also agree that sometimes different measurement bases may need to be used in the statement of financial position and statement of profit or loss. However, about a third of respondents, mainly represented by academics, accountancy bodies, and standard status, disagreed with using different measurement bases in the statement of financial position and statement of profit or loss. And in particular, they expressed concerns about increased complexity and also interaction of those proposals with other aspects of the exposure draft, such as definitions of income and expenses and presentation of information about financial performance. Staff analysis and recommendation are set out in paragraphs 14 to 29 of Agenda Paper 10D. In the light of feedback received, we recommend that the board confirms the proposals on the use of more than one measurement basis. However, we recommend that the board also state that in selecting more than one measurement basis, not only relevance but also faithful representation of information needs to be considered. So this would be to align the discussion of more than one measurement basis with the board's tentative decisions on the use of profit or loss and OCI, and that would also be consistent with the general discussion of the factors to consider in selecting a measurement basis. In addition, we also recommend that the board clarifies that using more than one measurement basis in the statement of financial position and the statement of profit or loss is one example of classifying income and expenses between profit or loss and other comprehensive income. So that would be to address concerns about the interaction of these proposals with other aspects in the conceptual framework, such as presentation of information about financial performance. Alternatively, the board could decide not to provide any clarifications. So the question for the board is on page 10. There are three sub-questions in that question, and we would like to take votes on those sub-questions separately. With that, I turn it over to the board.
Julia, about face presentation, you know, we describe how to choose the basis from relevance and the face of presentation. Have no problem. But if applied to OCR category, how can we discuss, you know, under such circumstances, because of faithful representation assessment, you will reach at a measurement basis, which will get two. How can you have?
I think the main
general point of fair value cost is easier, but how can we get the third category as a result of faithful representation?
What we were talking about, I think what drove us partly to this was when we were discussing accounting mismatches, we talked about that in terms of faithful representation, so that we said in order to avoid avoiding accounting mismatch would help contribute towards a faithful representation. And it seems that some of the uses that we make of OCI are enable us to avoid these sorts of accounting mismatches. So you might want to get cost-based information into profit or loss, but have current value information in the balance sheet, and you want the cost-based information in profit or loss to avoid accounting mismatch with something else that is reported in profit or loss on the cost basis.
Why is that not relevant, though?
The original conceptual framework talked about, the exposure draft talked about it in terms of a faithful representation, so it talked about it resulting in a faithful representation of the performance of the entity. Of the financial position and financial performance of the entity. So it says if you ended up with an accounting mismatch in your income statement, you might not have a faithful representation of the performance of the entity.
No, I have no problem you keep silent. But if we want to clearly say that, you know, to assess, to get to the third category, and you have to look at the faithful representation side,
I think what we're saying is not that you're sort of required to consider both. So what we said in PNL and OCI is that it can be either relevance or faithful representation that makes the board decide to use OCI for a particular income or expense. So essentially we are proposing that we mirror that in this instance. So it's not that you're required to consider both, but it's more that either of those fundamental qualitative characteristics might lead you to decide to use more than one measurement basis.
Stephen.
Where would measurement uncertainty fit into all of this? So that would be part of faithful representation.
Yes.
So if something was a uncertain, difficult to measure item, that itself could be a reason to use OCI?
Not necessarily. I don't think they're saying that.
That's not what we usually use it for, is it?
Well, I'm just wondering whether this might lead one to use that.
We have a general discussion about measurement uncertainty, and we say that measurement uncertainty can, in some circumstances, reduce the ability to provide a faithful representation of items. And we have lots of caveats around that general notion. I don't think that this discussion, either about dual measurement or about the use of OCI, in any way changes the basic decision that you've made that measurement uncertainty is something that can affect the ability to give a faithful representation. So in a way, you're questioning that original decision about whether measurement uncertainty should affect faithful representation, rather than whether faithful representation is something that should drive decisions about OCI, I think.
Is he questioning that, or is it more that in the past we've at least, when I was thinking about it, maybe incorrectly, was thinking that it was more to do with cost versus fair value, whereas this is the first time it's been considered explicitly in the context of both happening at once, so it brings up the whole OCI question.
Although, of course, when we were talking about the original, the decisions that we made on the use of OCI, we explicitly introduced faithful representation into that.
But also, when we made the decision on OCI, the board explicitly decided to say in the conceptual framework that OCI will only be used in exceptional circumstances. So it's part of the decision of the board. So that's an additional thing.
My recollection, and maybe it's wrong, so tell me if it is, was it was more to do with the relevance of profit or loss in the period, that type of thinking. So it had a relevance focus, but you're saying it was also faithful representation?
The original exposure draft was couched in terms of relevance, but you made a decision to add faithful representation into that.
So this is just in line with it.
As a general principle, to look at both sides, no problem. And the board change in our previous proposal to move uncertainty into faithful representation, I have no problem also. But in link the OCI decision, particularly with faithful representation, I try to imagine and then come out what Steve just said last night. You know, I don't think this is our intention. This is why I said, you know, keep silent, I have no problem. If you want to say so, then I will say, under what circumstances, because of the conservation of faithful representation, we arrive at OCI, in heart. In
but
I think perhaps one example I would use there would be and this actually is not necessarily an example of dual measurement, but for example, when you're looking at the cash flow hedges, I think the reason why you want to put the fair value gains and losses on cash flow hedges into OCI is actually about avoiding accounting mismatches, and we describe accounting mismatches, avoiding accounting mismatches as being part of achieving a faithful representation. So that's the sort of...
Yeah. And we actually use that specific example in the staff paper when we made the decision to add faithful representation to OCI decisions. And here, because we're arguing that the case of dual measurement is one example, essentially, of classifying income and expenses, one example of using the OCI, logically, you would also consider faithful representation here.
Yeah, and it also seems to me, and I don't know if this helps, that you're not just considering whether the number that appears in OCI is representationally faithful. You're looking at all three aspects, I think. The number that you get in profit and loss, the number that you get in OCI, and the number that you get in the statement of financial position. So I don't think one would necessarily conclude it just on the, you know, by looking at those individually, so to speak.
Maybe just one final observation. So if you look at in the appendix to paper 10D, if you look at discussion of point A6, it talks about whether the use of dual measurement is an exception, whether it's not an exception. And so basically in response to this question, we're saying, well, because it is one case of when you use OCI, and reusable, shareable only happen in exceptional circumstances, it logically follows that the use of different measurement bases in P&L and financial position is also exceptional. So we already have this covered as well.
Okay.
Stephen's comment about measurement uncertainty. So, for example, we just discussed in the IFRS 13's PIL discussion, we discussed unquoted equity investment. And the fair value measurement of unquoted equity investment is quite difficult. So then, because the measurement of unquoted investment is not quite certain, so can we say that this is the reason why you can use fair value OCI for unquoted equity instruments, so that you can put a fair value measurement only on balance sheet, but because there is a lot of measurement uncertainty, it might not be fair to put it in performance.
But again, as the board discussed, you would need to weigh wasteful representation and relevance. And if you decide that cost does not provide relevant information, then relevance consideration overweighs the difficulty of measurement.
It should be considered both relevance and,
Okay, do we need to vote?
I think we probably do need to vote on
that. Okay, can we vote for all three together?
Yeah.
Can I see who supports the staff recommendation?
No, I'm
maybe, I'm not sure.
No.
Yeah. No.
Sorry. 8 in favour.
No,
8 in favour. 8 in favour.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you, Richard. Can we move on to Elena, your paper? So, the next paper is agenda paper 10E, and we are now moving to a separate exposure draft that was issued to support the main one, and it talks about updating the reference to the conceptual framework. This exposure draft was aimed at avoiding having several versions of the conceptual framework after we issue the revised version. And it proposed replacing references to the old framework in IFRS standards. It proposed also removing the related clarifying footnotes and removing the corresponding quotations from the framework in the standards. The feedback we received on these proposals is summarized in paragraphs 9 to 10. In principle, the respondents supported the proposal to move to just one conceptual framework. However, there was a group of respondents who suggested that the board should undertake an analysis of the effects of the proposed amendments to assess whether any material unintended consequences could result from updating the references. There were also some specific concerns about particular proposals, which as we discussed in this paper, and we'll go through them one by one. And we'll start with the proposed amendment to paragraph 11 of IFRS 3. This paragraph sets out the recognition conditions for assets acquired and liabilities assumed in a business combination. And the recognition in IFRS 3 is based on the definitions of assets and liabilities in the framework. And some respondents were concerned that the proposed changes to the definitions in the framework would lead to changes in the recognition of assets and liabilities in a business combination. In the course of our project, we performed a testing of the revised definitions. And this testing, the results of which were discussed at the October meeting, showed that some concepts may give a different answer to the existing standards. And in this case, it could lead to changes in assets and liabilities qualifying for recognition in a business combination. Furthermore, this would also mean that in some cases, it could lead to day gains and losses, because post-acquisition accounting in IFRS is based on IFRS standards. And we identified one example where this could happen, and this is levies, because in accordance with the
concepts supporting the definitions in the revised conceptual framework, a liability for levies could be recognized earlier than as required now in the IFRIC 21. In post-acquisition, this liability would be derecognized because entities would have to move to IFRIC 21, and this could have a material effect. The proposals in the updating reference exposure drafts were not intended to have a significant effect on the requirements of IFRS 3, and it could lead to unintended consequences. At this stage, we do not recommend replacing the reference to the framework in IFRS 3. However, in the long term, we would like to achieve our aim of having just one conceptual framework. So we are also proposing to start a project to make narrow scope amendments to IFRS 3 that would allow the replacement of the reference to the framework while preventing the day two gains and losses. And those amendments would not have to be fundamental because IFRS 3 already has some provisions for different items that do not go for the basic recognition. And we would also aim to complete any revisions expeditiously so that to minimize the time when we have two frameworks in effect. So question one asks whether you agree with the staff recommendation to retain the reference to the framework in paragraph 11 of IFRS 3 and start a project to make narrow scope amendments to IFRS 3 to replace the reference to the framework.
I'll speak in support of that. I think the initial idea of pulling out the references to the frameworks and putting it out as a separate exposure draft to separate the impact on preparers from the impact on the board was an appropriate and very neat solution. And I think that exposure of that has identified this item as one that is, I think a justifiable concern. And so I think it is better to pull this out and not hold all the rest of the changes and cleanup going ahead rather than holding up this whole cross-reference to fix this one item. And I agree with the staff's analysis that we've done enough work between the analysis you presented in November and the additional, the testing of the definitions that we did kind of for independent purposes, but you've leveraged well here, that we did in September, so that I think the suggestions to do a lot more field work, et cetera, broadly are excessive, but I think you've got the right kind of target here with this one to pull it out and go forward this way.
Yeah. Okay, so we agree?
All in favor.
So then moving on to the next proposed amendment to paragraph 11 of IS8, and this amendment would affect preparers who, in the absence of a standard that specifically applies to a transaction or event, develop accounting policies by reference to the framework. Some respondents questioned whether this amendment could have a widespread effect or cause a practical issue. In response to this, we performed an analysis of the effects on preparers' accounting policies, and we presented the results of this work in November. The work performed suggested that the scope of any changes to accounting policies is likely to be limited. The work suggested that most preparers do not develop accounting policies by reference to the framework because most transactions are covered by the existing standards or accounted for applying other sources in IS 8 or are exempted from the requirements to apply paragraph 11 of ISAs. Also, in some areas, the revised concept will suggest similar accounting outcomes to the existing concepts. For this reason, we recommend replacing the reference in paragraph 11 of IS 8, and this is question 2 of this paper.
You all agree? Yes?
Yep. All in favor.
Now, the next next section talks about the amendment to the description of the characteristics of users in IS1, IS8, and IFRS4. This description is included in the discussion of materiality in this standard. And the only difference in the description of users is that the old framework specifically assumed that users are assumed to have an accounting knowledge. And some respondents suggested that users should be expected to have an accounting knowledge, and if this is omitted from the description of materiality, it could lead to some changes. For example, entities would have to disclose all the accounting policies instead of just significant accounting policies. Here I'd like to note that in December you decided to issue an exposure draft proposing some clarification to the definitions of materiality in IS1, and this exposure draft would also propose adding the revised description of users from the conceptual framework as it is now. So as it is now part of a separate project, we propose retaining the existing description of users in IS1, IS8, and IFRS4, but deleting the reference to the framework. In this way, the requirements of the standards would stay the same until the project on clarifying the definition of materiality is completed.
Agreed?
All in favour?
Yeah.
Now, the last section of this paper covers all other proposed amendments. There were some other comments on particular issues, and they are summarized in Appendix 1. Those comments did not suggest to us that other amendments would have a significant effect on the requirements of the affected standards. And for this reason, we propose replacing the remaining references and updating the related quotations in those standards. We also recommend removing clarifying footnotes, as no objections were had on this issue. There are also a couple of other notes that I'd like to make. One of them relates to the process, how those amendments are going to appear, because we exposed only the main text of those amendments, but we would like to just clarify that each of those amendments will be accompanied by a basis explaining why the amendment was made and how preparers are likely to be affected by it. We also reviewed whether the proposed amendments are up to date, and we would like to note that amendments to 627 are no longer necessary because it will be superseded by IFRS 16. Also, we are proposing to update references in the main text only. We think that it would be misleading to update the reference to the framework in the basis, because basis explain the board's reasoning at the time when a standard is issued, so it should refer to the version of the framework applicable at that time. However, more recent standards have some reference to the conceptual framework that was issued in 2010, and in some instances, having those references may be a bit confusing, and we will go through them and just perhaps add clarifying footnotes just to explain which framework was meant at that particular point. So question 4 asks you to confirm the proposals in the updating reference exposure draft to replace the remaining reference to the framework in IFRS 2, IFRS 6, IS1, IS8, IS34, and 632, and to remove clarifying footnotes.
Well, this is the part in the staff proposals that caused trouble to me. I think Yelena mentioned that there would be in the basis for conclusion an explanation of how what kind of changes these amendments could trigger, so that in fact the analysis by preparers could be channeled in some way. But we haven't seen in fact these descriptions. By the way, the constituents have not seen those descriptions either at that stage. And to me, I mean, if I put IFRS 6 alone, when I look at the other amendments. I'm not convinced that they're different than from being editorial in effect. So I wouldn't want this to trigger analysis in practice and controversy, which in conclusions for basically nothing or very little. So IFRS 6 I've put aside because there I could see eventually how the some effects could be anticipated, even though I think the effect analysis that was provided in November would suggest that eventually there would be none. And I think basically when I look at where the changes could have an effect, whether it was I-37, I-38 that were left alone at the stage of the exposure draft, IFRS 3 now that is subject to a particular specific analysis, I would either leave IFRS 6 alone, most probably, but if we want absolutely to update at this stage, then I would want this to be considered separately.
John Wu.
Thank you. May I ask on the item here, page 16, item A4 in the appendix A. I would like to suggest you to explore a kind of a option to remove almost every reference to framework and not to add any new terminology, conceptual framework in current standards. If we can do, eliminate everything, almost everything, then maybe that in the maybe next 10 years, if we have another conceptual framework amendment there, we don't need to do these things, updating referencing. So there is a very good example. That's why I'm saying in A4 here. IS 34, paragraph 31, you replace the framework by conceptual framework. That relates to the description of the recognition. So I guess it might not be necessary at the level of standard. So this is one possibility to remove the total the reference of the framework or conceptual framework. So if you go to the next paragraph, 33, on the next page, page 17, you deleted the framework at the first the sentence of page 17. Mm-hmm. The framework says expense and income, because this is a kind of description of the conceptual framework on this expense and revenue. This is a kind of change in assets and liability. So while you are removing this kind of a framework here and description of this is a very good example. If we don't need any some kind of repetition of the some kind of definition of the elements, recognition, measurement, we don't need to update this reference later. However, you're still keeping the last, if you see the last sentence, the conceptual framework does not allow the recognition of items in the balance sheet, which do not meet the definition of assets and liability. It's absolutely true. So this is another example we might think absolutely they are eliminating, removing this reference to framework. This is just one good example. You tried that possibility, that alternative partially on this IS 34. However, if you do this kind of removal of the reference of this conceptual framework might be very good for your step for the next 10 years later.
I see your point. I think our overall strategy was to replace the reference because that was a decision taken by the board. Here in IS 34, we deleted one of the references simply because the framework doesn't say this sentence anymore, because this sentence included a direct reference a direct quotation from the old framework that will not be carried forward, so we had no option to sort of replace it with anything else. And we thought this sentence was not essential enough, and deleting it would not change the substance, that's why we deleted it. But everywhere else, we tried to replace the reference rather than...
Yeah, I understand your justification, but I just like to suggest to think about this possibility. Expand that removal alternative on all these updating reference. Yeah, I can accept you if you just maintain the current policy, sometimes removing, replacing everything. But if we can do more for the future, think about this possibility more.
I think I would be a little bit worried about going down the route of removal, given that we haven't actually exposed the notion of removal. What we've done is to expose what we think was the appropriate approach for each of the individual ones. I'd be a little bit worried about unintended consequences of going for a removal without actually going through some sort of exposure on that.
Stephen?
I wanted to go back to IFRS 6 and ask Francoise more about this. So you're saying that we should keep the existing reference in IFRS 6 to the old conceptual framework and not replace it?
I'm saying that my issue with all this is that we are telling people we don't expect significant effect. We have even some effect analysis that might be incorporated in the basis for conclusion that will hint to the fact that it's likely that there is no change to be made. But we can't affirm, or we don't want to affirm, that in fact there is no material change, but as expected, as a result, no analysis is needed. So I think we are leading people into considering a possible change with a very high likelihood that in fact there is no change. So I think it's a very useless cost to have.
So what's your suggestion instead of the staff recommendation?
IFRS 6, frankly, I would leave alone, so not change it.
But that means the old framework has to stay in the book forever until we change IFRS 6.
Well, but I mean, it's also an area where we don't expect that there would be an effect. So you would not have an accounting that is in reality in contradiction with the framework, because you don't expect a change. So you're not expecting a contradiction.
But I mean, how could we have two definitions of an asset in our book long term? I mean, I accept that there's sort of difficulties in some other areas, but.
IFRS 6 is basically an exemption and the opportunity for people to continue what they were doing before, subject to a certain number of disclosures and checks. Why would we infer having people look into it, analyze, to conclude there is no change needed?
Well, that often happens when we issue a new standard. I mean, that's not a unique situation. I mean, for many people, when they introduce IFRS 15, they're not going to change, because many people have simple transactions. I mean, we wouldn't contemplate leaving the old standards in place just for that reason. So I don't understand why we would do it here.
And for the other amendments, as I said, to date, I believe they are editorial in effect.
So you're okay with? Because I wanted to just check. So for those other ones, not the IFRS, not the six ones, but the other ones, you're okay with the proposal to make a change as long as somehow we make it clear that it's editorial in nature, so people don't sort of read between the lines that we think there's some fundamental change. Is that your suggestion for those ones? Just to be clear.
Today, I have not identified a source for the change. I would need to see the analysis that is intended to be put into the basis for conclusion for forming a definitive view.
Okay. But you're not objecting to the idea of us making the changes in those other cases as long as it's clear enough from the basis and theory that it's editorial in nature? Is that what you're... I'm just trying to understand what you're proposing.
It really depends.
Okay. Very well.
My question is related to what Chung-Wu just asked, but slightly different, in particular related to 34. Yes. Please look at the table, paragraph 31. I'm not sure which page, 16? Yeah. 16.1, you know, Chung-Wu actually mentioned, you know, the recognition, you know, actually the in all the ones, it include meat definition as well as, you know, the and satisfy the criteria for recognition. And how about the second part?
So can you just say, which paragraph are you looking at?
31.
Page 16.
A4.
1631. Right. So if you look at the old ones, you delete the second part, mm-hmm. satisfy the criteria for recognition.
Well, that is the proposed definition of recognition in our revised conceptual framework. So we are incorporating it.
Now this is the problems, and this is caution quite often. I repeated the same, you know, the proposed framework compared to the old one, we segregate, you know, definition, recognition, measurement in some aspect. And as a result, you know, in some circumstances, we should not only look at whether someone meet definition and then you conclude you should recognize or not. And if we purely look at the definition, I checked, you know, the definition of the recognition in the ED looks like, you know, you're right, you know, mm-hmm. recognition defined as you just captured. Mm-hmm. But actually, when we really want to discuss the recognition issue, we should not only discuss the definition, but also, you know, the criteria to recognize. And this is why, you know, I follow what, you know, Chung-Wu just pointed out, you know, from slightly different angle. You understand what I will say?
Yeah, I see how sort of taking an isolation is sort of misses criteria for recognition. But that would be the question for the main exposure draft, whether we want to somehow adjust the definition of recognition.
So this is the worry I have, repeated several times, you know, for example, we delete, you know, possible cash flow in the definition of assets, and we also, as a result, we don't discuss the probability in the recognition criteria, but we discuss the principles, how to, you know, reach conclusions, and we have, you know, relevance, you know, faithful representation and other consideration. And if, you know, we give people impression, you know, recognition is a result of test or whether you simply meet the definition. I don't think it is enough.
I think just having a look at in the context of the whole sort of section on IS 34, I think that there is probably a point there that actually what this is trying to do is to describe the process that you need to go through in terms of thinking about recognition for the purposes of putting together the interim report. And I think that part of that process you would need to think about not only what is the process of recognition, but also the recognition criteria as to whether you actually go ahead and recognise the item. And I think the amendment that we've made here perhaps doesn't actually capture that, and we might need to go back and have a look and see how we can tweak that to make sure it does capture that appropriately.
Okay. So
are we going to discuss the B, Appendix B?
If you'd like to, yes.
I'd like to. So the word reliability, B2. So I said this previously, that we're going to leave that word in our standards all over the place, mm-hmm. and the proposal is not to do anything about that word, and it's coming out of the framework, and it leaves this question about how that word should be interpreted. Now, part of the reason why we change is because I think it's been written in different standards by different people in different boards with slightly different meanings. Yeah. But we're going to leave it in these standards, and it's going to, I think, create some challenges in the future. So Wegro has been talking about IAS 41, and the word reliability comes in there. So measure at fair value, but don't if the fair value is determined to be clearly unreliable. And I'm not sure that's being used in the way that we think faithful representation is. I think that is purely a measurement uncertainty reference. So are we, well, the proposal is just to leave it, and I'm not happy in not doing any further work at some stage on this.
The difficulty is, without huge effort, how can you distinguish those reliability only related to uncertainty, or reliability capture other concepts, you know?
But I thought we have decided not to change all kind of standards which are not 100% in line with the conceptual framework, and I see that in the same area. Maybe there is some should do, but should we do it immediately? No, but if we do something on 41, maybe we change it. And why is that different to other kind of things which we decide not to do immediately?
It's a piece of work.
Well, because we've taken away at least some help that we had before, that it was in the framework. I mean, I would argue we haven't. Faithful representation is the same thing, and this should actually be read in the context of faithful representation, but I'm not sure people are. I mean, I don't know how people are reading.
That would be, we'd have to do a big piece of work and expose it, right? Because I think it could have real practical consequences for people if we were to go through and strike through and replace.
Yeah, I'm not suggesting we change anything now in the work we're doing on the framework. I'm suggesting that this is something we should.
Well, in terms of cleanup, there are, I think, long lists of things to do now. But that may be maybe for a later stage.
Our own cost benefit.
But so noted.
It's just
Mary?
Just to tag on to Steve's comment, I'm relieved that he's saying don't think we can do it now as a further consequence of the updating, because I think it's beyond what we proposed and discussed. But I did note when looking at this that Rachel's going to kill me for this, but the one of the things we contemplate from principles of disclosure and its different work streams is that there would be potentially a fundamental update of IS1. You know, that's a potential, not a certainty. And if so, I'd hope that even if this is not directly on point, that we put this as a to-go connected with that kind of, if that ends up resulting in a wholesale overhaul of IS1. I guess maybe, is it that, or is it more primary financial statements that might do that?
I think it could potentially be either.
Okay.
Well, the problem is that IS1 is a little bit of a strange standard.
Yes.
It's got several different sections to it. Principles of disclosure and primary financial statements are very much focused on the sort of two parts of it that deal with disclosure and deal with presentation in the primary financial statements. There is that other section that deals with things like reliability, etc., that we've had no discussions on as part of of either primary financial statements or principles of disclosure. I think that would be an increase in the scope of either of those projects if we took on an amendment to that section of IS1 that deals with things like fair presentation, like reliability, etc.
I'm not sure that we'd have to do all of those things, but given that we have discussed it and fleshed this out of conceptual framework, I would keep it on the to be considered when we get to there, once we have a sense of what the rest of the scope of the project is, because while we think about it in chunks of what we're doing, I think many of our stakeholders think about it. They're looking at IS1,
yeah,
you know, and they wrap their minds around what's in that. But thinking about our good friend IS1, I did want to offer an editorial comment, not change, but comment A5. I think the staff is trying to give us, on page 17, trying to give us reassurances that the language is clear enough about, so there isn't a risk that people may be looking at the conceptual framework and using it to justify recognizing something in OCI that was not specified by the board. I think we keep forgetting that IS-1 says very explicitly that you don't recognize anything in OCI unless permitted or required, and so therefore there is zero risk that that will happen because everybody has to apply IS-1. It's not like you conclude you're outside the scope of that standard. So let's not send inadvertent signals that somehow that IS-1 prohibition might not apply by saying, don't worry, we'll make sure the drafting is tidy. Because I think it's a non-issue to begin with.
Okay.
We need to vote on question
four.
Four.
So who agrees with the staff recommendation?
So therefore we will...
4A.
4A.
Four.
Yeah.
Yes?
We raised issue about 34 upon recognition criteria.
Yes, I think we said that we would try and deal with that in drafting and see if there was something we could do in that area.
Okay.
To Francois's point about it being sort of editorial, we are going to try and make it clear that we're not meaning anything profound by changing these.
Yeah, in the basis for conclusions, we're going to have a discussion about what the expected changes are, if any, on these. And I think our conclusion is that in most cases, these will not have an effect.
Okay. 4B.
11 in favour.
All right.
So now moving on to agenda paper 10F that discusses transition provisions and effective dates for this amendment. The updating references exposure draft proposed a transition period of approximately 18 months for this amendment. It is also proposed to be meeting early application. The amendments would be applied retrospectively, except for IFRS 3. The feedback we received was largely positive and supported both the transition and effective date. However, again, those people who asked for a more comprehensive analysis of effects of those amendments did not provide an opinion on the transition and effective date. Now, paragraphs 10 and 11 summarize other comments made on this issue, and we will go through them in this paper. The first issue that I'd like to note is that some respondents grouped the amendments into editorial and substantive, and they raised a concern why those editorial those amendments that they considered to be editorial were even accompanied by a transition and effective date paragraphs. And we would just like to clarify that this adding this paragraph is part of the requirements of a due process handbook, and this paragraph should be added to all amendments except where we're correcting drafting errors made when writing or typesetting the documents. Now, moving on to transition provisions for the proposed amendment to paragraph 11 of IS-8. That is the one that will affect those entities that develop accounting policies by reference to the framework. Those entities will have to review their accounting policies, and we received some comments with suggestions that this amendment should not be applied retrospectively, but should be applied to new accounting policies only or prospectively. Those who suggested applying it to new accounting policies only thought that it would be onerous to require to review all accounting policies. However, I'd like to note that if this amendment was applied to new accounting policies only, it would mean that some accounting policies of an entity could be based on the old framework, some could be based on the conceptual framework, and it would also lead to lack of comparability between entities for the same transaction depending on the time when they developed their accounting policies. Also, the staff believe that if some concepts were withdrawn or superseded in the revised conceptual framework, the board thinks that they no longer produce the most useful information, and so that those accounting policies should be reviewed. Also, the work suggested, the work that we did on analyzing the effects of this amendment suggests that only a limited number of policies is prepared by reference to the conceptual framework, and for this reason we do not think it would be unduly onerous to require the revision of all accounting policies. So we do not recommend amending the transition provisions so that the amendment would apply to new accounting policies only. However, there is one area where we thought that requiring the review of all accounting policies could be unduly burdensome, and this is rate regulation. Rate-regulated entities develop their accounting policies on the basis of paragraph 11 of IS 8 if they adopted IFRS before the effective date of IFRS 14, or if they elected not to apply IFRS 14. And those entities would have to review their accounting policies if the amendment goes forward as proposed. Both our team and also the rate regulation team prepared the papers that considered how the proposed concepts could help the board develop an analysis of the rights and obligations of rate regulated entities. And those papers suggested that the revised concept would not give a definitive answer. So we think that the revision of accounting policies by preparers in this case could lead to diversity in practice. Moreover, those entities will have to review their accounting policies again when the final standard on rate regulation is issued. So that could be, of course, disruptive for both users and preparers. So we are proposing to bring a paper to the future board meeting. We'll talk to the rate regulation team and see if any transition relief is needed for those entities. So now moving back to the suggestion made by respondents that the amendment to IS 8 should be made prospectively. Here we suggested retrospective application, even though it can be more complex and costly, but it makes information comparable, and so it is expected to be more useful to users. We would also like to note that those amendments would be applied retrospectively in accordance with IS 8, and IS 8 already has the provisions for cases when retrospective application is considered impracticable. So we recommend confirming the proposal to apply the provisions, the amendment to paragraph 11 of IS 8, to both existing and new accounting policies and retrospectively, and this is question one of this paper.
Doc.
Thank you. Actually, I recall some education session initiated by Mike Wells. Mike Wells initiated the framework-based thinking or framework-based teaching. And what he said was, before you go to standard, you have to look at the conceptual framework, and you have to grasp what's the economic substance of the transaction, whether there is an asset or whether there is a liability, what kind of accounting treatment should be appropriate first, and then look at the standard. So. That was the things we have been provoking for a long time, because we are saying we are principle basis. We address to the all kind of accounting issues all over the world. Therefore, conceptual framework is very important. So for this type of conceptual framework, I don't think it is quite appropriate to require retrospective application, conceptual framework itself. And also, I do understand your proposal, because this is not purely application of conceptual framework. We are talking about application of standard, because each standard refers to conceptual framework. So So therefore, we have to decide whether it should be retrospective or prospective. Having said that, not only those standards which refers to conceptual framework, but also all other standards would be affected by conceptual framework, because the conceptual framework is the base of the judgment, of the base of the application of the standard. So therefore, if we are saying that you should apply it retrospectively only for those standards which are referring to conceptual framework, is in a sense makes an inconsistent application. So therefore, I rather prefer not to require retrospectively, but just require prospectively would make more sense in the case of conceptual framework.
Can you just clarify here that we see, you already discussed the status of the framework, and we said that it is not a standard and will not automatically to lead to any changes of the standard, and
yes,
standards, the provisions in the requirements of the standards prevail.
Yes.
So and we do that, not think that...
Is then the term application not very... is it appropriate?
It is appropriate in the sense of those amendments that we are proposing, but we are, nobody proposes to apply it directly. We are talking about the application of those amendments to the standards here.
It's those situations where an entity is developing an accounting policy in accordance with the conceptual framework that we're talking about.
Because I think that Tech was sort of talking about question one and partly question two as well.
Yes, yes, question two as well, yeah.
I was trying to focus on question one in the first instance, so where IS 8 is being used to actually develop policies. It might be good to look at that in isolation first. That's what you were trying to
yes.
do, right?
Yes, and this is the situation where there is no standard that covers some sort of transaction. That's when we go to the framework, when preparers are required to go to the framework in some cases.
Well, I don't disagree with retrospective application as a principle. I think it's when it's feasible, I think it's largely the way to go. But I feel comfortable to impose that without any form of possible fallback. When we don't know what people are going to face. So in the paper, there is the argument that because we don't know, we are going to impose. And in fact, because we don't know, I would say, well, we can't impose.
But why do we even bother? I mean, we don't expect the impact to be big. Direct application of the conceptual framework doesn't happen all that often. There are not so many missing links in our standards. Why is this?
I think that, but that's why for me, I think there could be a difference in the logic we might use for question one versus question two. Is that fair? Because question one, if somebody really genuinely, there is a gap in our standards and they've had to use the framework to develop their policies, then perhaps they would come to a different conclusion because we've changed the framework. But in question two, and maybe I should set aside IFRS 6 because it's a bit harder, but for the other ones, because the standard sets out the requirements, and if we really think there's not going to be too much consequence of changing the references, to Françoise's point about if we really mean it's editorial, then in that case, would it not be easier to argue that prospective application might be more justifiable, particularly because we'd expect any changes to be...
I'm just worried that if we talk by talking about retrospective application, that people start imagining things that it is going to be much more far-reaching than it really is. That's my worry. Why bother?
I think with the IS 8 amendments, I think that our analysis has shown that there is a small population of entities for which they will have to change their accounting policies, and that could have a significant effect on
them.
But it's
just
a small
give them perspective.
Oh.
Yeah.
But then the users of financial statements are disadvantaged. That upsets trend analysis.
And what does prospective mean? Does that mean two different accounting policies for transactions entered into before and after the date?
Doesn't it mean you change all your policies in accordance with the framework on the day, but it's reflected going forward? Yes. It's prospect of application, but they're all reviewed.
So there's a cumulative catch-up adjustment when?
No.
Beginning of that?
You just change going forward. There's no cumulative catch-up. Cumulative catch-up would be retrospective application, but not retrospective restatement. Prospective means I just change my accounting going forward, but I don't adjust.
So old transactions that have yet to work through are under the old policy? Or it has to be, because otherwise there'd be a cumulative catch-up adjustment.
ISH says that prospective application is applying the new accounting policies, transactions, other events and conditions occurring after the date at which the policy is changed.
Yeah.
So it would be to new transaction, but to the old ones.
So what's the difference between paragraph 23A and B? New transactions.
23A
and B
of this paper. Just checking.
So 23A would say if I've got an old policy, it continues to apply to all transactions, whereas 23B would be you change your policy, but it only applies to new transactions.
Yeah.
That's the difference. Okay.
Yeah.
So sorry, I misspoke.
The problem is, though, that prospective isn't defined very clearly because the definition in ISA talks about new transactions and balances, and the problem is sometimes transactions are not the same thing as balances,
yeah.
So it's not actually well defined. So if we just say prospective, people won't necessarily know what to do.
So we never know what we're talking about when we talk about prospective. Gary?
For reasons expressed, I don't agree with restatement or retrospective. You said you get a small policy, small universe of possible transactions or policies. I hope there are standards. I mean, pretty much everything is covered somewhere or another. You might debate the level of detail, but there's very few unaddressed subjects in there. And it's a small universe of possible transactions. I mean, retrospective doesn't do anybody a whole lot of good in this world. It's difficult to do, so I would disagree with paragraph 35. Retrospective is potentially, it is more complex.
I think it will send a signal to the market, well, you better look through everything.
Yeah.
And now you got a change in accounting policy in response to a conceptual framework which itself doesn't set standards. You know, it just doesn't work.
So doesn't materiality deal with this?
Well, you've got materiality might deal with it. Mm-hmm. But the point was, you make a directive, you shall do it retrospectively.
If it is material, rather, the effect is material, surely we would want retrospective application. Why wouldn't we apply IES 8?
Our statements under our standards tend to be 2 years. We're only talking 1 year comparative.
Yeah, but our
that can be handled with a footnote.
But our default is to think that retrospective application is better information for users of financial statements. That is our default.
But generally, they got to read it once, you know, and the footnote in the year that you got the two different bases in it. I mean, it's not something that just continues on forever.
Well,
Gary, you're worried about restating comparatives, not doing, you'd accept a cum catch to get everything accounted for consistently.
But whether
right?
It's the cum catch or just start doing prospective, I think that's a different discussion. I mean, I'm certainly talking, I don't agree with restating.
Martin is going to plead for retroactive.
You should not think about that. It's only that in practice that people have to review then maybe a bunch of accounting policies and look, do I have to change something? If we require retrospective application, that means that people have to look at each and any accounting decision in the past where they have referred to, okay, to the framework in this case. And that is impractical to do.
Yeah.
It is not, I think it is not policies, I would agree, but it is any accounting decision. And that, I think, is impractical. And if we have concluded in our effect analysis that it is not a big case, we should not bother about this effect. And therefore, we should make it costly easy and we only require prospective. Because otherwise, it is a huge effort. People have to go through all kinds of accounting decisions. They have to remember 30 years ago, if I have made a transaction and maybe refer to the old conceptual framework, and do I have now to change it because I have a new conceptual framework? And that is impractical to do. And therefore, I think we should require only prospective. It is different. We should not, in practice, that we have 10 pages of accounting policies to review and look at the transaction. It is each and any accounting decision was made in the past by, even if it's not documented, maybe, probably, you know, because it is years ago. Steve?
I would just add that, of course, IS8 does have an impracticability exemption in there.
Yeah, it's costly. I would say it's too costly because people have to review it.
You have to prove it somehow.
Yeah, prove it.
Steve?
Are we talking about accounting decisions? Yeah, I mean, I accept what you say, but this is about accounting policies.
Yes.
Yeah, but this is it.
Specifically,
underlying transaction.
So it's a policy from the accounting decision. You have done it. You have accounted something which you don't have a specific IFRS requirement, and therefore you have done your own thing, and it is related to the framework. That is from your accounting policy. You have taken make an accounting decision based on the framework. That is a policy. That is I interpret seeing that. Why is it different? Is the policy if you need something in writing or for many transactions or if you have applied that to only to one transaction? Is that a difference to your
I could see your argument, Martin, if you had something which was a sort of long life transaction. So say, for example, you had a 20-year lease, and leases is a bad example, of course, because that wouldn't fall into the scope of this because it's in the scope of the leasing
but
standard.
You have to think about it.
But for most things, as long as the transaction has worked its way through, then how could it have an effect on what you have in your balance sheet or your income statement?
I don't know, because my problem is you have to think about this. You have to think about, do I have this kind of existing transactions which I have made maybe for years in accounting decision, maybe it is still ongoing. I don't know. But I think you have to think about all that. And my point is our effect analysis has shown it is not a big issue in the world, so why would we bother and why we cannot say, okay, don't do all that work and make it prospective.
Darryl.
So I think now we are arguing about all three possibilities. I think it's whether it's retrospective, whether we do a cum catch-up, or whether I think what Mark is proposing is a pure forward look. Now, I think what our analysis has shown is that there are very few transactions that are subject to measurement criteria based on the conceptual framework. My understanding certainly is if you have material transactions based on measurement criteria based on the conceptual framework, you need to have described that policy. Now, I think the difficulty is, as much as I agree with Martin, that it doesn't have, when looking at the whole economy, it doesn't have a big effect. When you're looking at individual companies, it could have a very material effect. And I think to leave in place the old framework with the new framework, to say that companies don't know when they've exercised the framework or not, I find quite difficult to get my head around. So I would say that we should, I would probably prefer to require retrospective. If we're not going to require retrospective, I think we should at least require cum catch-up and allow retrospective. And I think in many cases companies, particularly again if this is material, want to do retrospective because they want to be able to explain their current year's results. There was one other point that I think was also coming up, which is I think I agree that this is of limited, and I think Hans, a part of your problem is that you worry that people will read this and mean that it's a big deal.
Well, I
think we need to make that clear.
I was really surprised that we were even having this discussion, given all the discussions that we've had about the impact of the fact that in Europe it's not even endorsed.
I think almost in some ways, and I know we're sort of semi-scoping it out, but I think the rate regulated is a example of something where it could well have a significant effect. And just to say, well, leave your old rate regulated balances on the balance sheet, and as you add new ones, add them under a different policy.
That's not covered by our standards.
That's an example of places where this might occur.
Yeah. But I think that will be covered by the interim statement. Mary.
Briefly on question one, wanted to express skepticism that any special discussion is necessary for rate regulated activities. But if the staff's ready to do a paper and bring it to us, I'll withhold my skepticism until we see that in terms of turning it into a final decision. On question two, which is I think more what we've been discussing, I think we may have a bit of a self-inflicted wound here because we have a requirement today in IS8 that applies unless we say something else. That requirement in IS8 is if you change an accounting policy, you have to apply it retrospectively unless it is impractical. And so that applies unless we say you don't have to restate the comparative period, instead you do a cum catch, or unless we say apply it prospectively. I think for some of the reasons Daryl cited, it would be bad for us to permit or require a company for, you know, one of the isolated cases for which it might be material to have a disconnect in its accounting. And I would be even more unhappy if somebody has an accounting policy that gets grandfathered by this, that they, you know, they don't have to change because they managed to get it in place before the new conceptual framework came in. And I think that's an entirely hypothetical. I don't expect, you know, it to be pervasive. So I just say, let's just be silent, let ISAID apply. ISAID says what you do if you can't restate the comparative periods, but how you do a cum catch. And I think we just leave it there, and don't have any extended commentary. I just say, you know, update the changes, and you know, subject to the carve outs, etc., and point out that if you make a change in accounting policy because of these, you apply ISAID.
Which would mean apply retrospective.
I think this is the most reasonable idea.
Which would mean retrospective, but everybody is comfortable with how you apply ISAID in terms of deciding when it's impracticable, when it's impracticable to restate, but you do cum catch, figuring out what you do about 35 years ago in a transaction that you might have done one way.
I think, Mary, if we did stay silent, then effectively it's the same thing as the...
But I'm just saying, point them back to ISAID, because we've got established practice about how you deal with Martin's problems of 35 years ago you had a transaction that might not have...
But wouldn't ISAID come in the context of we've written a new standard or revised a standard,
but it
and
also
this is all part of the...
But this is opposed
to a new conceptual framework.
No, but this is an amendment to... The document we're discussing puts in amendments to standards in terms of which they're cross-referencing. So I think ISAID would cover it.
Okay.
Yeah. Good question, but I think we'd cover it.
Yeah, we do it by reference to ISAID anyway, because the transition paragraph actually says an entity shall apply these amendments retrospectively in accordance with ISAID accounting policies, changes in estimates and errors.
Yeah.
But it's just an avoidance of doubt thing, if you like.
Yeah. Well, staying silent is something. Might be preferable.
I think Mary's suggestion is very, very reasonable, sensitive, and encapsulates almost everyone's concerns about the issue. Just apply ISAID. I would go for that.
ISAID.
ISAID. Because I'm used to call anything ISAID. ISAID.
In this case, I would support Martin.
In the case of Martin, we would. I think Martin's concern is extremely sensible. But when you go to IS8, as Mary just expressed, actually it would apply if you change your accounting policy. If we go not to be silent right now, what we are going to do is write a new paragraph, saying that for accounting policies that are subject to the new conceptual framework, you apply prospectively. So these might cause more work than simply being silent and following IS8 right now at the end of the day. And the result will be the same.
But only one question. I would agree what Mary said, but do we think if an auditor come in and say, please demonstrate to me, okay, that you don't have any, because the conceptual framework has changed, maybe as a new definition of asset. In the past, you have maybe referred to the conceptual framework. Please show me your retrospective application, or demonstrate it is impractical. And how do preparer react to that? That is my point. Is it? Do we give sufficient relief if we think it is not a big issue?
Maybe we have to offer some commentary, and I don't know if it would be more than in the basis for conclusion. Just as a signal of what we're thinking about, that we are focused on what current accounting policies have to change.
Mary, my point is, usually if you change an accounting policy, you know that.
Yes.
And that is easy then. But in this situation, maybe you don't know what.
I, But that's why I say I think maybe if we offer a commentary that says our focus in making these changes is on currently applicable accounting policies. It doesn't give everybody a total get out, but it's saying what we're trying to do is identify the circumstances in which somebody is required to change a current accounting policy.
So can somebody make a conclusion from
me? I'm hearing sort of mixed messages, because I'm hearing some people who actually think retrospective is a good idea. I'm hearing some people saying actually that they have concerns about the practicability of a retrospective application. I'm hearing other people say, well, we should just stay silent. On the stay silent point, just to be clear, if we stay silent, it's exactly the same as saying retrospective.
Yeah, of course.
But then we wouldn't have had this discussion. But this goes to show what being obvious about something.
We would have had to give an answer.
Yeah. Yeah.
We need to have a conscious decision on whether we want it to be retrospective or prospective, I think.
I agree with you, Rachel, that staying silent is in effect staying retrospective, because that's what I say requires as the norm.
Mm-hmm.
But I think by spelling it out, we sometimes say this is a supercharged version of what's in ISA, and you have to do a more exhaustive search, etc. And I think we are just aiming for the plain vanilla. If you change your accounting policy, do what ISA normally tells you to do.
Which is what stuff is, yeah. So
there's one additional, sorry, there's an additional difference is the impracticability as well. In staying silent, you also apply the impracticability.
Yes, and we're clear that in our transition and effective date paragraph that you apply it in accordance with ISA 8, which has that impracticability exemption in. I mean, I have no objections to us staying silent. I just want people to be clear that if you do vote for staying silent, it is the same effect.
Maybe there is a problem with saying retrospective in accordance with.
Yes.
That kind of implies the impracticability is not there. I know you could read it the other way, but it opens up the question of.
Okay.
To Martin's point, isn't it important to signal it's a relatively light touch thing that we're after? Because from a preparer point of view.
By this amendment in accordance with.
Shahul would like.
The only other concern we have is the due process handbook, and thank you to Elena and Yuli for pointing this out. It's a standard or amendment in a standard has an effective date and transition paragraphs and transition provisions.
I really think that if we've got a default paragraph in 8, I think if we're silent, and by implication, that is the transition paragraph. Otherwise, why the heck would we have a default?
Or just say, apply, say, don't editorialize, like, retrospectively.
But what does it mean from when is that effective then? Is it then conceptual framework will be effective from the day of if we make it public, right?
That's
and so
the
people have to do then one day later.
That's the next question.
But if we don't change that, but I think our sort of the transition is then, okay, effective date for these amendments is then maybe 18 months.
Yeah, and that's
but
when they
if we don't change that, is it then immediately effective, right? That people have to do the next reporting period and they have to do that new policy. Isn't that the consequence?
Yeah.
If we don't change, if we don't make this change, if we follow Mary's suggestion, what is then, let's assume we make the conceptual framework end of this year effective, do they have to apply that end of the year?
No, so we would still have an effective date paragraph which would tell
for
you when you
amendments.
Apply the amendments.
Yeah, but
we
don't
say
want to make an amendment. That was my
No. I was saying don't say anything about transition method, but still keep the 18 months, you know, mandatory effective date 18 months after,
because
what we're talking about doing is amending the standards that
amending
refer
the standard,
to
but don't see, say anything about transition. Okay, I understand.
I think being silent is not very helpful to people. And indeed, even if it is implicit that it is ISA, I think it's better to say that it should be ISA. The issue I have is that for cost benefit, on the basis of cost benefit consideration, it's not been common that the ISP has issued transition requirements that were, in fact, easier to apply than ISA itself. So what I was looking for when I introduced that subject was for having IS 8 as a reference, but having some form of undue cost of effort supplement to it, which arguably in practice is not being considered as such when IS8 is applied, and let people go for prospective or modified retrospective application if they are in this circumstance, because we can't we don't know what we're talking about. So even if it's isolated cases, for those isolated cases, it may be a material cost, a material impediment, and we cannot say, well, then they're not many, so just don't worry.
I'm sitting here listening to this and say, in my former life, if this situation landed in front of me, it even before I looked to the materiality or immateriality exception, even before I looked to the impracticability exception, what I might try to argue it is the framework was a great document, but it was not authoritative. There is no other authoritative standard. The new conceptual framework is also not authoritative in its direct sense. So therefore, if I had a preferable accounting standard under the framework, maybe I just have an acceptable standard under the new framework. And therefore, the absence of being told I'm wrong, there's nothing wrong with what I'm doing. I'm just saying, I'm just putting that in the room. You don't have to react to it. That's how I would approach it, is I still don't know that I'm wrong, you know.
You might be thrown into doubt about that.
If you're relying on the old framework that's been superseded, doesn't mean my old policy is wrong today. It just might not be preferable under.
So how can something be applied prospectively or retrospectively if it's not authoritative?
Well, that's part of the point here. I would say, look, my old policies have been downgraded from preferable to acceptable, and that's not an error, it's just okay.
Although
I'm just trying to think, that's how I would first, is a path of least amount of work, you know, try to argue it.
The IS1 tells you to go to the framework, right? Mm-hmm. So that sort of brings in the words of the framework in some circumstances, right?
But the framework itself says it doesn't supersede or create a standard.
But this is where there's a gap.
You know, so you got this do loop in there that doesn't close off well.
This is where there's a gap. Yeah.
Jung-woo?
Yes, I would like to suggest that this bring this issue one more time. The reason why I'm saying is the current debate discussion is not so conclusive. Another thing is that this is related to the transition approach for the conceptual framework of whole. Another thing is we just postponed the discussion of IFRS 3. So these are all some big projects of these three. Among these three projects, the transition approach must be consistent with each other. Mm. So maybe rather than just focusing on this IS 8.11, we need to get a more big picture of this whole project. So in that case, it might be easy for us to make a decision.
Well, I think we should do an effort to come to a conclusion here.
Well, what about Francoise's idea of making the hurdle easier for people? So instead of saying it's impracticable, using the words undue cost or effort, which to the Korean and Australian view, you know, concerns about making up new words are words we've used before in a different context, but we've used undue cost and effort in 9 and going to use it in 17.
So what then happens if it is an effort? What do they then do?
Well, the same consequences as 8. So 8 would say if it's too hard, then go back as far as you can, do cumulative catch-ups if you can, or I guess the worst case it's prospective. So it's the same sort of, you know, retrospective with restatement, or this, you know, the best versions you can do. The only difference would be instead of the hurdle being impracticable, which people tell us is almost never, Mary's going to kill me, I can see her face, we'd say undue cost or effort. So it'd be the same sort of outcomes, but the test would be a lighter test.
And you can't analogise to it?
No, it'd just be for this situation.
Yeah. Mary?
But my concern with that is we've had two strands running through this discussion, one of which is the work effort involved in considering and identifying which of your policies has to change, and the work effort involved in quantifying and adjusting previous information for those policies that do have to change. Mm-hmm. And while I don't love it, I could, I think, live with undue cost and effort in respect of the second one, you know, the previously recorded transactions and balances, you know, the restatement effect. But I don't want somebody to misunderstand undue cost and effort as the level of scrutiny that you have to apply to considering whether or not you have to change policies. Now, I understand Gary's, you know, what Gary said about in his past life, and I think he's making the valid point of the first thing that says is, tell me why this is now wrong and I have to change this accounting policy. Yeah. But, you know, and it isn't automatic that everything that you may have once cited a word from the conceptual framework automatically has to change. It's a show me why it's no longer valid. But I don't want to give relief from, I can understand trying to give relief in terms of how many periods you might have to restate, or, you know, but I think we have to separate out the, do you have to identify accounting policies that have to change, not it would be nice to update them, have to change from those that don't, and to say you only have to apply it when you develop a new policy. You only have to apply the the impact of the revised conceptual framework when you apply a new policy or to transactions after that date. So you're going to have two policies applying to the same class of transaction, depending upon when they occurred, is the one that's the really bad idea, and that's where my face would say I was getting upset.
I think our question one actually splits that those two notions into that. That so there's the notion that we want the transition, we want the revised conceptual framework to apply to both existing and new accounting policies. So you have to change, if you've got an accounting policy in place developed in accordance with the framework, when this becomes effective, you have to change it.
No, you have to consider whether to change it.
Sorry, yes, I take your point there. And then secondly, the retrospective then deals with this, with, well, what do I do in order to affect the change to the existing policies? Well, I need to do something retrospective. The question that was floated whether we put a different hurdle to impracticability, for example, no undue cost and effort, as being the hurdle for doing retrospective. So if it's going to be undue cost and effort, you don't have to do retrospective, and you do that what ISA
you
tells
have to do
you.
The policies, though.
Yes, you have to change your policies, but
consider your policy.
Yes.
Stephen.
I don't get the impression that many of our constituents had a problem with retrospective application. Are we overplaying this?
Yes.
Then why, for so many new standards, insurance, revenue, leasing, financial instruments, we are struggling with the transitional requirement?
I
spend so much time, you know.
We have done as much work as we can to try and establish what the extent of the potential problem here is. We issued the exposure draft, we got the comment letters. We weren't happy with the amount of feedback we got from the comment letters, so we did some additional work to try and establish what the scope of these potential changes are. Having said that, the conceptual framework is quite a sort of specialised area of accounting. There may be entities out there who just aren't aware of this. So although we didn't seem to get an enormous amount of pushback on retrospective, what is concerning, what might give you cause to pause is the fact that we didn't, there's been a limited amount of stuff that we could do to establish the extent of any potential issues associated with it.
Can I just comment on this? Because I think our experience has been that the more we try and pin down transition requirements, the more holes and problems we create. I'm better off usually trying to keep it as simple as we can.
I wonder whether we should just try calling the voters as it is and just see what happens, particularly now that you've pointed out to us, Rachel reminded us, that 1B is focusing specifically on the accounting policy.
Yes.
So, shall we start with
1A?
1A.
Ten in favour?
Yeah.
11.
Yeah. Then B, retrospectively or not. Retrospectively.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Are these proposed?
5.
Just as written.
Just as proposed at the moment.
Five in favour.
Then perhaps with the addition as proposed by Françoise. Sue.
We can.
So retrospectively subject to undue cost and effort.
Yeah.
One, two, three, four, five, six.
One B.
One, two, three, four, five, seven.
Seven.
Okay.
Yes, the seven stuff, yes. Thank you.
So it's effectively IS8, but with instead of impracticable, undue cost,
cost and effort.
Well, but you have to review all the policies, right?
I don't think so. I think because we're referencing paragraph 11 of IS8 that says you don't have to review all the policies. I think the retrospective that you wanted to kill is question two, not question one.
Yeah.
Sorry, no, because question two is where we've got the references.
In other stats. So question one is about the requirement to look to the conceptual framework
to
develop
your policy.
An accounting policy. Question two is about those other amendments to the other standards, so the IFRS 2, IFRS 6, IAS 1, IAS 34, so changes of the reference to the conceptual framework.
So question one's where we don't have a specific IFRS applied.
Yeah.
Yes.
Mm. So that means that if it's undue cost and effort, you don't have to revisit an existing accounting policy.
No, I don't think it's saying that. I think it's saying that once you've decided
you have to look at the policy, but then you have to decide whether to apply it retrospectively based on the amount of effort.
Once you have identified that there is a change needed,
yeah,
since the application of that change.
So what we voted for in 1A.
I'm sorry, the drafting then isn't correct because it's the drafting of the question. And because we're all hung up on the drafting, because you said that you applied the proposed change in the amendment, which is to update the reference from framework to the new 2017 framework. Mm-hmm. It says that you apply that change retrospectively, and what that means is if you only applied that change prospectively, let's say you concluded undue cost and effort, you would only be updating the reference in paragraph 11 on a prospective basis. So it may be just the drafting of the question.
Have a look at it. Yeah.
So the intention is you'd always look, but you'd only apply it retrospectively.
Apply the effect of considering.
Yes.
So it's the effect that's retrospective.
Yes.
Because the way the question is drafted, it says you'd only look to the new framework when you are applying this prospective.
Right, so the vote remains as it is.
Yeah.
Question two. Do we need to make the same addition? Or
it would be silly not to do the same thing.
Yeah.
The same thing?
Yeah, but including that addition.
10.
Yeah. Effective date, 18 months.
Would you like to comment?
Yeah.
Are we allowed to comment or not?
Oh, yes, sure.
Because I would see this paragraph of 11 of IS8, and I'm focusing on this one because I have not voted in favour of the others, to apply to new accounting policies as soon as feasible. But I don't think there is such an urgency that we need to ask people to have done that in 18 months for the review of their existing accounting policies. I agree that this has to be done, and we let people something like 5 years to get there, and they would do it when they find it practical to do it, especially in a period where major standards are being applied. Some might consider that they would do that concomitantly, and some would eventually want to do that at a later date, and don't really see the urgency in bringing what is assessed as being hardly any change. But
11 in favour.
Should we vote? Considering Françoise's
11 in favour.
So when possible it will be published. Now I will slightly change the decision. Now assume we publish
in October.
Second half.
Yeah, second half. Then so it looks like, you know,
probably give more than 2 years to prepare us because our calendar year are from
calendar year. You know, it will be much.
It will be a calendar year. I think we always use the 1st of January.
Yeah, 1st of January type of, you know, maybe, you know, 10 months, you know, rather than, you know, strictly 18 months.
Okay, so I guess this brings us to the end of our deliberations this month.